President Hardin, Father Folio, Chairperson Strickland, member of the Board of Trustees, members of the faculty, graduating class, your families and friends, ladies and gentlemen. I am mindful at this moment that a college commencement is that time in your life when you put on a robe you haven't worn before and listen patiently or otherwise to a speaker you haven't heard before while you are anxiously awaiting the moment in which you finally graduate. This day and hour belong to you and your family and friends, and I would wish not to delay it, but that's what I would wish to do. Unfortunately, it is a sad fate of all commencement speakers to do precisely that, and to inflict on you, in a sense, the last requirement of your graduation. I am going to try and excerpt a bit from a longer address. I wanted to speak today a bit about the problem of world hunger. This can be a highly emotional subject in this country because we're a rich country. And Americans enjoying the richest, most caloric, and in a sense the most expensive diet in the world, while at the same time they pay less for it in terms of their disposable income, very often have a measure of guilt when they look at the world around them and see that the United States, along with other developed countries, consume about as much cereal products to feed their animals, with 1 billion people, as 2 billion people in the world use cereals for food. And so it can be an emotional subject. It also touches on our basic humanitarian concerns. Former Secretary of State Kissinger remarked at the World Food Congress in the conference in 1974 about world hunger, that nothing more overwhelms the human spirit or marks our values and our dreams than the desperate struggle for sustenance. The United States, however, has a record, I think, of which we can be proud in addressing this great and central problem of humanity. No nation has done more to produce food, to trade with food, to give food assistance than has the United States. That historical record has come in part from our humanitarian spirit and from our great capacity to produce more, far more than we need at home, and from enlightened national interest as well. The first and foremost has been our capacity. No nation in the world has ever created an agricultural industry such as exists in the United States. It is an enterprise of $100 billion a year. And if one stretches all the related subjects of national commerce related to agriculture, it is fully a third of our entire gross national product. And yet this system is so fantastically productive that about 4% of our population free the other 95% from the responsibility of working in the farms and in the fields and produce for all of us and for millions and hundreds of millions of people around the world. From the very foundation of our nation, agriculture has been central to our national concerns. Even in colonial times, we became the supplier of foodstuffs to Great Britain, and by the middle of the 19th century, we were beginning to be known as the breadbasket of the world. In 1974, about 75% of all the exported grain in the world came from the United States. This capacity has given us not only the role of the world's greatest trader in agricultural commodities, but has given our economy this year $25 billion in earnings to buy the fuel that is so needed in our society, to literally buy the gasoline for the automobiles made in Detroit and here at Lansing. More people in the world look to the United States today for their food requirements than ever before. In the world beyond our shores, people consume 43% of our wheat, 42% of our rice, 44% of our soybeans, 34% of our grain sorghum, and 26% of our corn. Just about one out of every 3 acres in this country is farmed for export. Our historical role as a supplier of food derives from a second factor, and that is our concern from the earliest days, our humanitarian concern for those less fortunate. Long before the United States government provided any food assistance, philanthropic organizations, religious and otherwise, were making great contributions to relieve hunger and famine abroad, whether it was in China or Armenia. And in the days following World War II, the United States has been the greatest of all countries in not only providing direct food aid, but increasingly being the country which stimulates the agricultural development of countries abroad to enable them to produce more for themselves. We have followed this humanitarian strain, which underpins all of our government and private efforts in this area, because really of a central idea in the American tradition of the dignity of the individual. The United States has also operated out of enlightened self-interest. We have found that food aid abroad stimulated our own exports and developed great agricultural capacities here at home. Our supplying of food aid to Japan after the end of what the Japanese call the Pacific War changed the dietary habits of the Japanese, and accordingly, with the rise of income in Japan, they have become our principal export area for wheat. We learned at the end of World War I, however, that food had an enormous value in political terms. Probably our supplying of food in World War I was as important to a degree as the contribution of our arms in winning the victory for ourselves and our European allies. And after World War II, when Europe was laid waste, the United States restored the capacity of Europe with food aid first, and then with industrial and technological and capital assistance. The principal beneficiaries of the American government's efforts in recent years have been nations of the third world. For these have been and will long remain the countries where human misery is most acute. In 1975 and again in 1977, we have amended the basic food aid statutes to indicate that our primary effort ought to go on humanitarian grounds to the most needy nations of the world, to those nations with less than $300 per capita income, where hunger forms a constant condition of daily life. Why have we done so? We have done so again out of the concept of humanitarian concern, but also out of a concept of enlightened national interest, because I think we realize that no possibility for international stability or peace exists with hundreds of millions of people living on the verge of starvation. Hunger has always been the underpinning for stability, instability, for revolution, for war. It led the French to the barricades in the French Revolution. Lenin promised peace, land, and bread, and the hope for any international order of progress and peace in the future depends on the capacity not only of the United States, but of all nations of the world to cooperate effectively in meeting the challenge that lies ahead. What is that challenge? We have heard from many in the recent years that population will simply outstrip the world's capacity to feed itself in the next generation. These post-Malthusian predictions have often been proved wrong. We were told that there would be famine in the mid-70s, that there would be famine in the mid-80s, and we have grown to expect that the world will continue to be able to produce enough to meet its needs. Through the great success of the so-called Green Revolution, developing countries have increased their capacity to grow food by 38% in the last decade or so. And recent studies offer further reason for optimism, as birth rates in developing countries appear to be slackening and reducing. But we have no reason for total optimism. There are still estimates that by the 1990s, developing countries may be 125 to 145 million metric tons short of food. That could spell not only widespread malnutrition, but famine itself. What can be done? First of all, the United States is only part of the answer to this problem. We cannot feed the world. Great as our capacity is, we cannot, by farming every acre in the United States, feed another 2 billion people. And the most moderate estimates of population are that we will have a world population of 6 billion people by the year 2000. And some believe that we will have a population of 11 billion by the year 2020. Today, 200,000 humans are born. In a year, 70 million. In 6 years, another India. In 12 years, another China. The world must continue to work together in every conceivable cooperative venture to ensure that there are adequate food supplies for the future. The United States in the past has sometimes made errors in its food assistance. It has tried to export occasionally the highly capital-intensive agriculture of the United States, which is not always suited to foreign countries. And especially in the future, it will have to be careful about exporting technology that is appropriate to the use of these countries, technology that can meet the energy problems that these countries will face. But we must continue to provide research. We must continue to provide capital. We must continue to provide food to ensure that developing countries are able to meet the gap that lies ahead. The United States and other countries operating through international organizations have proposed a major international effort, a 10 billion ton food reserve, of which the United States would provide half. Developing countries must do their part as well. They must ensure that their own agriculture is adequately founded with incentives, that farmers have a tenure system which encourages their initiative and the application of technology that is appropriate, that markets are developed, that imports from these countries are recognized by developed countries as a contribution that they can make. The past has often been strewn with examples of developing countries which have sought to feed their people through cheap food aid while starving the incentive of their own farmers to develop their agriculture. I believe that the future can be met, the challenge can be met, but I think we would be foolish if we believed that it was an easy matter or a light matter to be ignored and be taken for granted. No issue, in my judgment, in the coming generation, other than the question of controlling nuclear weapons, will be more central to humanity's future than the question of whether it can feed itself. If we work together as an international community, the problem can be solved. The agricultural resource base exists, but we will need the political will among developed and developing countries, and we will need good luck. Because, as the philosopher observed, the world is not always wisely governed. If favorable weather does not occur, if international organizations fall into disarray or develop arguments over political irrelevancies, if developing countries do not appropriately structure their agriculture, if developed countries don't make the contributions, if the population trends reverse, if international military and political tensions are aroused, if any number of untoward things occur, this great challenge might be missed and the pessimists vindicated. And then I fear that no statecraft, no combination of dedicated statesmanship in the world may avoid a period of deep division, tension, unrest, and violence. I have spoken about this here because although this university has distinguished itself in many fields, and its graduates and faculty are known in many disciplines, it had its origins in agriculture. It was in 1855 that the Michigan legislature created the Michigan Agricultural College, of which this university has come. Across the distance of time from the last century to this, it's difficult for us to appreciate what a departure that enactment represented. While agricultural institutions are now many, there was none then. Never before had elected representatives anywhere voted to commit public resources to unite higher education and research in an effort to improve the most basic work of society. Yet out of that union, first made here in Michigan, where was to come a giant step forward as state after state followed the example of Michigan, and then, with the passage of the Morrell Acts, the United States government itself. Out of these beginnings, Michigan State has grown into one of the truly great universities. I'm especially aware, of course, of your College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. And you others will pardon me if I make special reference to that great school department and to the Institute of International Agriculture, which is known on every continent. Faculty and graduates of every college and department in a special way, however, Michigan State alumni have been active participants at home and abroad, wherever the effort was made to preserve our resources, to develop our food supply, to improve crops, to better the diet, and thus to advance the basic underpinning of human progress. Whatever your chosen field may be, of that great heritage, and with the honorary degree that I proudly accept today, I join you in that pride. It is my belief that the question of the United States and other nations meeting the food needs of the next generation, the next two generations perhaps, will be, as I say, the central question, along with peace itself, as to the future of mankind. This institution has always had a special role at home and abroad in that effort. I know it will continue. And I know that as Americans, I believe that as Americans, if we can share in that effort in whatever way our life and our circumstances allow us to, we will perhaps do more to advance our country's contribution to human welfare than any other single thing that the United States can do in support of the broader human community. And I believe that in that way, we will be true to the great traditions of freedom and liberty and humanity that gave this country its birth. I congratulate you. Whatever your journey in life, I wish you good luck and Godspeed.